Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching from God's Word you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to Him. If you're ever in the Madison, Alabama area, we'd love for you to worship with us on Sundays at 8:30 or 10:30 a.m. If you have any other questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, find us at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to also check out our Bible study podcast, Madison Church of Christ Bible Studies. Thanks again for stopping by.
I've shared with you guys before that the way that my wife and I approach vacations is completely different. She is more what I might call moment-driven. I am more schedule-driven. And I've come a long way. In fact, some of my family is even surprised at what Lorianne has been able to do to help me to enjoy the moments more. And what I mean by that is I'm one of those kind of people for years. Like if we were down at the beach, for example, I would be like, all right, it's 8 o'clock. By 8:30, we're going to be down in the sand. By 11 o'clock, we're going to be walking back to that little area where you can hose your feet off and get all the sand off. By 11:30, we're eating lunch. And by 12:30, we're all taking naps. And by 6:30, we're waking up from that nap. And so, like, that's the way I always approached a vacation. But she's like, Andrew, just enjoy it. Just take your time. And, you know, and I really have come a long way. It's amazing what she has helped me to become. Another example is my daughter. So if you would have told me like 10, 15 years ago that one of the suggested videos that I would see on YouTube the other day would be ballet songs, I would have told you you're crazy. Yet, because of Dulce Tiana, I have found myself not only playing ballet songs in my living room, but may possibly be participating in a dance or two with her. It's amazing that she has helped me to do things that ordinarily I would never do. Another example of this is my mom. So I was in middle school, and when I was in middle school, and guys, this is so crazy this morning, by the way. I shared the same story at the 8:30 service. One of the people that came up to me and asked me if I would be interested in preaching when I was like 12, 13 years old at the Midway Church of Christ, would you know it, of all Sundays, they're here this morning. And she's here in this service. And they came up to me and my family. We're at the Alabama National Fair in Montgomery. And like, hey, we know that, you know, y'all do Lads Leaders. Andrew, would you be interested in coming, you know, like once a month to the Midway Church of Christ and preaching for us? And I've told y'all I have a yes problem that sometimes in my mind I'll say, no, I don't want to do that. But out of my mouth I'll say yes. And that's what happened there. And I was like, I've always had in my mind that I want to do ministry, but Lorianne will tell you, I used to say this sentence, I will never preach. And it was because I didn't think I could put lessons together. I didn't want to put lessons together. But even just the thought of getting in front of people regularly, it terrified me. And so I remember talking to mom. I was like, okay, I appreciate them offering this opportunity, but I'm only going to do it like for a month or two. And then I'm not going to do it. I just don't think I can do it anymore. And she said, no, I'm going to help you. And so I'll never forget, we would get on our dining room table and she would be like, all right, so what's a Bible story that you learned about recently? Or what's a Bible verse you learned? Let's talk about that. And maybe what's a story that kind of pops into your mind whenever you read that Bible story? And what are some points that you could help apply to help people or help you? And so I remember my mom, who, you know, went to Faulkner for 2 years to study math, ends up helping me put all these lessons together. And what started out as just 2 months turned into 2 years. In 2 months, she and my dad were driving me to Midway Church of Christ. The reason why I give you those illustrations is I think we could all look back in our lives and over our lives and see certain women that have helped us to be where we are, to help us, to encourage us to do things that we did not feel like we had the capacity to do. This morning, we're going to learn about a lady named Deborah that helped encourage a guy named Barak that should have been bold, should have been courageous, but in the moment of weakness, she doesn't attack his weakness. She doesn't berate him, but she actually keeps his dignity intact and encourages him to do something that he didn't feel like he could even do. But I want you to notice something as we dig into this lesson today and we look in Judges 4 and 5, is that God has given every single one of us the responsibility to encourage other people in their calling. But once we have been encouraged in our calling, please understand, we then have a responsibility to do something with it and move from sidelines to servant, or as we're going to talk about today, spectator alone, to being a servant. So I want to go ahead and warn you, though, the text we're looking at today, and maybe some of you're even laughing now because you know where we're going with this, it's quite bizarre. It's got some interesting twists and turns. It has a violent moment, but it has a lot of very challenging moments. And so I look forward to getting to the text with you. And so here's how it starts. And it starts in the way that I told you in week one of this series when we looked at Samson, it would start. Almost every chapter begins with this. And again, the people did evil in the sight of the Lord. And the way I showed it to you was like this. This was a slide from our Samson lesson, was that this was the cycle that Israel was going through. They were in fellowship with God, but then their hearts would be given over to some kind of idol. That idol would enslave them. Then they would repent. God would deliver them. And then they would back in fellowship again. And I ask you guys, like maybe you've been like me before, that I look at this, and that's an example of me. And the way that I've lived before, I was like, man, if God were to come back, I really hope he catches me, you know, in this fellowship part. Like, that's not how I want to live my life. I don't want to live in this cycle. But the thing that I never really addressed in that lesson was what got them into this in the first place. Like, what made them at times give their hearts over to these false gods? Well, let's go back into our Bible history for just a second. Right before the book of Judges is the book Joshua. And if you remember in Joshua chapter 4, God's people led by Joshua, he's leading millions of people getting ready to go into the promised land. But right before they get into the promised land, if you remember, there is the Jordan River. And the Jordan River is incredibly symbolic in biblical history. It's known as a place of transition. It's where Jesus was baptized. It's where Elijah passed on the leadership to Elisha. And now God's people are about to transition into the promised land. And he says this, guys, the moment you step out, you put your feet in that water, the water's gonna part. And what's interesting about this is the water was at flood stage. So that's kind of a neat thing because it's one of those moments, you know, the size of the problem creates the size of the opportunity. They step out, the waters part. And if you notice in that text, the priest and the leaders, they're standing in the middle, taking it in. And we don't know exactly what's happening. I think worship's probably happening. Their jaws are dropped because they see water on both sides. But then God gives this instruction right after they walk through those waters. He said, what I want you to do is I want you to set up 12 stones. And the reason I want these 12 stones to be set up is that whenever your kids, your grandkids, your nieces and your nephews, the kids in your Sunday school classes, when they ask you what these stones mean, you're going to tell them what God has been doing and what God did. And from what we can tell in the book of Joshua, there went through a period of time where God's people were telling these stories. The kids were asking and the parents were telling. But then somewhere along the line, somewhere between this moment, Joshua 4, and Judges 2, where it says the people of the Lord, it says there raised up a generation in them that did not know the Lord or the things that he had done for Israel. What happened? Well, I'll tell you what happened. Somewhere between Joshua 4 and Judges 2, the people stopped telling the story. Now, let me ask you, did the stones go anywhere? No. From what we can understand, the stones were still there, but here's the issue. The story was not being told. And the reason why I want to mention that is every single Sunday, we gather around the Lord's Supper table, we take of these emblems, and these emblems have so much weight and meaning to them. And it can't be merely, hey, we just take this because we're supposed to. We as parents, as Bible class teachers, as grandparents and aunts and uncles, when we explain what these emblems mean, we need to make it personal for them to know how God has redeemed me, how God has redeemed you. Because here's the thing, we do this every week. Just like these stones, these symbols, these memorials, they haven't gone anywhere. We just have to make sure the stories are being told. In fact, when I showed that graph to Cruz, he said that one of his school teachers said, and it was not Lorianne, but said that they call this the cycle of apostasy. That round and round you go. And if you think about what was it that caused that cycle of apostasy, it's spiritual amnesia. That spiritual amnesia can cause that spiritual apostasy if we don't share and remember what God has done. And so it says they did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord did this. He sold them into the hand of a guy named Jabin. And Jabin was the king of Canaan. And then the commander of his army was a guy named Sisera. You need to hold on to this. He was leading the people of Israel. It says, the people of Israel were crying out to the Lord for help because he had 900 chariots of iron. Now, when you first read that, that may not seem like a big detail or a big deal. Because we think about our armies and our tanks now. But I want you to understand, like, a chariot of iron was kind of like a tank then. And one of the things I read said that one chariot of iron had the capacity to mow down hundreds of people with just one chariot. And so what they would usually do with these chariots is they would tell the horses to go, and the chariots would just run over people and kill hundreds. And so 900 chariots of iron, that's doing a lot of damage. And we're going to find out that God's people have 10,000 people in their army, but turns out it still, we would think, wouldn't be enough for this. But what I love about this text and what still sticks out to me is that the people of God are crying out, but yet they're not worthy of God's grace. They're not worthy of his mercy, but he gives it to them anyway. So now we meet Deborah. So Deborah was a prophetess. The wife of Lapidoth was judging Israel at that time, during the time that Jabin and Sisera were making things miserable for them. And so she used to sit under this palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel would come to her for judgment. The name Deborah means bee. And I grew up hearing a phrase that my mom sometimes would say, busy as a bee. It's the idea that they've got a lot of things going. Well, she had a lot going on. She was a very busy lady. A lot of people would come to her to get advice on things, to help her. They would get help from her to know how to like handle a dispute if they were going through a difficult time. But I want you to notice something about the text here. It says she sat under a palm tree. Now, palm trees during this time were incredibly symbolic. A palm tree sent a message. Now, I don't know if you guys are like me, that even if you see a picture of a palm tree, how do you feel? It's inviting, right? It makes you want to put a hammock from one palm tree to the other. It makes you want to sit under it. It makes you want to like look out at the ocean, put your feet in the sand. That if somebody during this day was sitting under a palm tree, the palm tree was symbolic because it sent this message. That the atmosphere of that person was an atmosphere of safety, victory, and grace. Now, the reason I want to point out that detail is, do you put off like a palm tree type vibe? Do you provide a palm tree atmosphere? Are you a safe person people can talk to? Are you somebody that when you talk, and it's not wrong talking about things that are negative and things that are difficult, but are you a kind of person that can see the good in something? Do you let grace flow from your mouth? That it turns out that because she provides this atmosphere of safety, victory, and grace, it's not just inviting to other people, but it's about to be inviting to a guy named Barak that was being anything but bold or anything but victorious. And so she sent and summoned Barak and said to him, "Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded you to go and gather men at Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun, and I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." So Deborah's just reminding him of what God has already said. And so she's like, hey, listen, Barak, you know, you're the commander of the army, and remember what God said. He's going to help you. Like, if you just get your men and go down into that valley, God's going to help you win this battle. And notice what he said back to her. If you go with me, I will go, but if you will not go with me, I won't go. This is the commander of the army. Like, could you imagine, like, back in the day, General Schwarzkopf being like, well, yeah, I'll go if you go with me. Like, what? No, you're the commander of the army. And if, like, something was said like this today, you know what we might say? What's wrong with you, man? Like, come on, what are you doing? I mean, is he being courageous? Is he being bold? No. And the reason why I want to point that out is this is a common theme all throughout the Bible, and it's this, that God does not reward courage with a calling. He creates courage with a calling. And what I mean by that is a lot of times we'll say, well, if God will just give me the courage to do it, then I'll do it. He's saying, no, I'm telling you to go, and as you go, you're going to find yourself doing things that ordinarily you didn't think you even had the capacity to do. Because y'all remember last week when John shared with us about Gideon? When God came to Gideon, where was he? He was underground threshing wheat. In case you didn't know, you can't do that. It takes actually wind and being outdoors to thresh wheat. They would throw it into the air, and when it would go in the air, it would separate. And so the fact that he's underground doing this, God's like, what are you doing, man? That's not even a thing. But yet he doesn't say that. He's not like, what are you doing? You're making an embarrassment. That's not working. Like, that's not what he says. You know what he says to him while he's underground? Mighty man of valor. It's a picture of how God doesn't see us at times for what we are, but who we can be. That's why he's saying, you want courage? Step out. Do something. We're going to see today how she's going to give him the right type of encouragement. He's going to move this guy from spectator to servant. So he said, right, if you go with me, I'll go, but if you don't go, I won't go. And notice how she handles this. She doesn't berate him. She doesn't make him feel terrible about himself. She says this, I'll go with you. Nevertheless, though, and she's honest, though, the road on which you're going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak. Now, when you read that last sentence that I highlighted, will sell Sisera, that's the bad guy that's leading the bad guy's army, into the hand of a woman, who do we think it's going to be? Well, you think Deborah, right? Turns out it's not Deborah. That's where the twist in the story is about to happen. I want to point this out because one of the things that I feel like in our culture that is under attack is men, like being a man and leading as a man is under attack. And when I read here in this text how Deborah encouraged Barak, I think there's something that, yes, everybody can learn, but I will say specifically, women, you can use as kind of an outline of how to encourage a man and encourage a man to lead. Because there's a few things that kind of stick out, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I love how she strengthened Barak by coming alongside him. She didn't try to do everything for him. She gave him what is one of the most important things she could give him, the strength of her presence to help walk him through it. I want to give you ladies a secret about men that's probably not a secret. You can Google this. That the number one fear that men have is the fear of failure. We want to do well at whatever we do. We like to win. By win, I don't mean like other people lose. We just like whatever we do to be successful at it. In fact, I'll go ahead and tell you this. We will hang in there with something that's even crazy as long as we know we have a chance to do well with it. I'll give you an example. We can watch a football game or a March Madness basketball game with two teams we don't care a lick about, but because there's an underdog on that TV screen that's fighting till the end, we're going to watch it. And it can go on till 2 in the morning with these two teams we don't care anything about, but we will keep watching it because there's a chance to win. But the moment that the underdog starts getting beat by 4 and 5 touchdowns, bam, TV's off, right? And the reason why I'm saying that is she, I think, is attuned to that. She comes alongside of him and gives him the strength of her presence. The second thing I love about her is she turns his attention back to God. She keeps saying, and the Lord is going to do it. The Lord is going to do it. She doesn't try to take credit for herself because she understands she is limited in her capacity. But she points them and him, excuse me, to the one that's not. But I also love the fact that she keeps his dignity intact. One of my favorite books is a book called When Helping Hurts. And in this book, it's really about how to help people in a way that actually helps them. And the main point of the book is helping people in a way that keeps their dignity intact. That we don't ever try to help people just based on what we think they need, but we help people based on the fact that we see them and God sees them as children of God. And I love the fact that she doesn't try to be like, I'm going to just do it for you. What are you thinking? What's your problem? There's nothing like that. She just goes alongside of him even when he feels weak. So when we get to verse 11, now I want to stop here for a second. This seems like a very random detail. It's not, because it's going to play into the story later. Verse 11 says this, now Heber the Kenite, separated from the Kenites, moved his tent as far away as the oak in Zananim, which is near Kadesh. Wait, hold on a second. We were just talking about Barak and Deborah in this imminent battle against Sisera and Jabin, and all of a sudden the Bible thinks it needs to mention this couple that gets in a fight with their neighbors and they pick up their RV and move to the middle of the country. Like, what in the world? Like, what does this mean? Well, turns out this is going to play a really important role later, that they moved to where they did, because the wife of this guy is going to play a huge role in winning this battle. So when Sisera was told that Barak had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out his 900 chariots of iron and all the men who were with him. So Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. I love this, that even still, she's not saying into my hand. She's saying into your hand, like you're going to do this. Does not the Lord go before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. Now I want to stop here before you read any more. They were up at the top of the mountain with the 10,000 men. And they come down to this little valley where there's a river. And I want to point out the detail. It's a dry season, okay? So they come down there. Sisera decides to come down to the valley. And the reason why I want to point that out, he has 900 chariots of what? Iron. You don't go down into the valley unless you know it's what? It's dry. You ever tried to lead something really heavy through a muddy area? It's impossible. So they come down and meet in this valley, but it says the Lord routed Sisera, meaning obliterated them, and his chariots, and his army, before Barak by the edge of the sword, and Sisera got down from his chariot and ran away on foot. Now, a casual reading of this will leave out this detail, but if you flip to Judges 5:21, the reason they were routed is God sent a rainstorm. They went down in that valley during the dry season. This is kind of like snow in July. He's not taking a chariot down there if he thinks or even knows there's the possibility of rain. Yet he goes down there. God sends rain. And it ends up being kind of one of these situations that what was their advantage turns out to be what? A disadvantage. And by the way, kind of a fun fact. Do you know what Canaan and their main god, false god they were worshiping was? It was Baal. Do you know what Baal was the god of? Sudden rainstorms. Isn't that interesting? That God used that very thing to send them a message about who the one true God was. So they get stuck. Sisera runs away on foot to try to get away. And remember that random, not random detail of that lady and her husband that got in a dispute with their neighbors and moved in the middle of nowhere? Well, Sisera flees to their house. So Sisera flees on foot to the tent of Jael. Now, during this day, husbands and wives, especially at this period in history, oftentimes lived in two separate tents. And the reason was, it wasn't like, you know, like you used to see in the 60s on TV shows, that's not the reason. The reason why they would live in two separate tents is to protect the wife. that it was known that the husband would live oftentimes in a separate tent, because if an attacker was to come, he was to leave the wife alone, and the wife was safe in her tent. So Sisera, who's running away, knows this detail. And so he's not going to the husband's tent, he's going to her tent. And I also want to point out the fact that she's really good with a tent stake and a hammer. And part of the reason, whenever it says that it was the tent of Jael and she was at home, that the homemakers were usually the ones that set up the tents, put them up. Okay, so that's an important detail too. So there was peace between this group of people, or so he thought. And so Jael came out to meet Sisera, who was running away, and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." So he had turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug. So she's basically saying, "Hey, why don't you come in and lay down?" Now, when you read this at first, I first read it, you know, "Turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." But when you hear what's about to happen next, I now read it, "Turn aside, do not be afraid." You know, like in a very like creepy voice, because you know what's about to happen next. So reading it in that voice, evidently he's a side sleeper. He turns aside and she covers him with the blanket. And y'all ever notice, like, when it's time for bed, kids come up with all these sorts of things like, "I'm thirsty." Right. "You just drank a gallon of water. Now you're thirsty." Well, he's thirsty. He says, "Please give me some water to drink, for I'm thirsty." And she's like, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to give you this skin of milk." And she gave it to him and covered him. Now, why do you give somebody milk at bedtime? You want him to sleep really good. In fact, some translations say that it was warm milk. So she's wanting him to be out. So I want to give you a warning, men, that if you like are getting ready to go to bed at night, your wife gives you some milk and a blanket, just look to see if she happens to have a tent stake in her hand. Because it says this, "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if anybody comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' just say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and a hammer in her hand, and I love how it says she softly went to him, drove the peg into his temple until it went into the ground while he was laying fast asleep from weariness. And I think this is the second shortest verse in the Bible. So he died. Wow. You remember the very beginning of this text where it said that Deborah was like, "Hey, listen, now I'm going to go with you, but I want you to understand that this victory is going to be won from a woman." At first, it might seem like it was Deborah, and I do think she played a role in that for sure. But isn't it interesting what seemed like a random detail God set up to have this family exactly where they needed to be? So they end up, of course, Sisera and Jabin, they lose the battle, and God's people are victorious. And what I love in this text is right after the battle has been won, Deborah and Barak, these two people that are warriors, that are leaders, they still understood that they needed to worship and give praise to God. Now, I know that might seem like an odd detail, but if you'll notice, Judges 5 is just all worship. It's them worshiping and praising God and thanking these surrounding nations for coming to their help. And the reason why I want to point this out is that there's a direct connection between us, especially as men, in our worship, leading in that, in the faithfulness of our families. In fact, there's a book that I was told to read in graduate school, and it was called Strong Fathers and Strong Daughters. And this is true whether there's a daughter in your life or not. It's a picture of how faith can be passed down from one generation to the next. But in that book, one of the things it talks about is the importance of fathers and men being passionate worshipers for the next generation. And one of the things that I have just loved so much about Madison since I've been here is to hear the men not be afraid to sing out. Now, I know that you can sit in a pew and sing something out to the top of your lungs, but be empty in here, okay? I understand that. But I do think there is definitely something to us as men putting our guard down that I think Satan wants us to have up. And in hearts that are full of praise and love for God, letting that praise flow. And the reason why it matters is because if you continue to read in this text, that when the leaders were leading in that, guess what happened? The people were praising the Lord. There was a direct connection between the passionate worship of the fathers and the mothers, the leaders in those communities, and the faithfulness of the family. But I also want you to notice this detail that we can't overlook. In verse 23, it's the whole text. Deborah is praising this country and this group of people for helping us in the battle and this group of people. Then all of a sudden you get to verse 23, it says, but curse Meraz. Well, what in the world? Why are we cursing them? Well, they must have done something bad. I bet what they did is they had a war crime. They stole from people. They lied. They did one of the seven deadly sins. I bet that's why they're being cursed. No, it says curse them because they did nothing. They were just spectators. They were just sitting on the sidelines. The reason why I want to point this out is that when we talk about church, church is not just a religious event you attend. It's a family that you are a part of. And if you're reading this text like I am, when it's very blatant and honest about where we are, it doesn't say that sitting on the sidelines is just going to rob you of a reward. It says that sitting on the sidelines is going to put you under a curse. Like, the world defines wickedness in a lot of ways, but oftentimes and most of the time defines wickedness by what we do. But this text is also defining wickedness by what we don't do. Think about Jesus for a second. Did Jesus say, hey guys, here's what I want y'all to do. I want y'all to get together and just watch me attentively. No, he said to what? Take up your cross daily and follow me, to go where I go, to have conversations that I have conversations with people about, to love people that are difficult to love. He said to follow me. At the very beginning of the message, I told you that to me, this lesson challenged me in two ways. Number one, to be an encourager to people that maybe need encouragement, but also to understand that once we've received encouragement, to understand we have a responsibility to go from sitting on the sidelines to being a servant, from going from spectator to servant. Maybe you're here today and you look at your life and your walk, and maybe part of what is defined by right now is just merely sitting on the sidelines. Maybe you want to move from spectator to servant. You want prayers for that. We would love to pray for you. Maybe you don't want to walk in front of everybody today. You don't have to. Every Sunday we have our shepherds that are at each and every one of the exits. You can walk to them, and they would love to pray with you and for you. Maybe some of you have never made the decision to put on Christ in baptism, to receive the gift of the Holy Spirit, to be added to God's forever family, the church, to have all of your sins washed away. We would love to help you in any way we can, to help move you from spectator to servant and to live that life that God has all called us to live, while we stand and we sing this song together.